Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the world has generally made progress in human rights over the past half century, similar areas still have room for progress. As the Sochi Olympics get set to start this week, much attention has been paid to the anti-gay legislation in Russia and its discrimination there. But my guest today has been involved in a form of discrimination that flies largely under the radar: discrimination and accessibility for the disabled. Back in 1980, the last time the then Soviet Union hosted the Olympics, they refused to host the Paralympics in Moscow, saying there were no disabled people in the USSR. Now in 2014, Russia will host the Winter Paralympics next month with very accessible facilities. Yet Sochi's disabled population and most of Russia's disabled population will be inaccessible to most of the events, as many have trouble even leaving their homes due to accessibility issues. My guest today is Dr. Andrea Mazzarino. She's an anthropologist specializing in contemporary Russia and is currently a fellow at the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. There she's researched and written various reports on human rights abuses, and she's the author of a new report on accessibility for people with disabilities in Russia, analyzing access to education, healthcare, and the physical environment. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Andrea Mazzarino, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
The eyes of the world, as they like to say, will be focused on Russia later this week when the Winter Olympics open in Sochi, and next month for the Paralympics. Now, besides the Games, people will be watching very closely security efforts in this part of Russia, discrimination issues, and of course, when most people think of discrimination, they think of Russia's anti-gay laws in place, but you've looked at another form of discrimination and accessibility, and that is accessibility for Russia's disabled population. What did you find when you looked around?
Well, we did research in six different cities in four regions of Russia. And I'll say that Sochi fared no better or worse than the other cities where Human Rights Watch interviewed people with disabilities and their families. One of the key things that we found, and probably the first thing that sort of struck me, was that there are many people with disabilities who simply do not leave their homes. They are confined between four walls because their apartment buildings lack accessible ramps and elevators. And this is especially important because Russia has a very progressive accessibility law at the federal level that mandates that all physical infrastructure and information, so library books, for example, be accessible to people with disabilities, and that you have thousands of people in Russia who simply cannot leave their homes because of basic infrastructural problems is a really important finding. And connected to that is the fact that many people do write into their local housing authorities requesting to be relocated or something as simple as a ramp to be built inside their home.
And what's the reaction for most of these letters? Is it a matter of the government not being able to accommodate it? Is it a matter of whoever owns the apartment block ignoring it and there's not effective regulation, or what exactly?
That's a really good question. It's a combination. One, I would say, is the ineffective regulation. The federal law that I described doesn't have any associated mechanisms to train government workers to respond to these letters.
So it's a law somewhat in name only?
In name only. It's important. It's important because any law that declares such a thing is making a statement about the government's position towards people with disabilities. But the fact is that in the majority of cases that Human Rights Watch documented, people do not receive responses on time, and usually the response is no such housing is available, or buy yourself a private apartment or a new apartment. An example in Sochi would be a 26-year-old woman who, when I met her last February, had not left her apartment for 4 months because she had a light physical disability. She had cerebral palsy, and her building lacked an elevator, and it had no exit ramp. So here you had this intelligent woman who had all the potential in the world who simply couldn't do so much as go to the store.
And I remember reading that story. She had an elevator in her apartment, but most of the time the elevator was either out of order or they had frequent power outages.
Right.
And I guess once she got outside of her apartment, she was fairly mobile. I mean, I guess the neighborhood around was not too bad, but it was just actually where she lived was not accessible for her.
Well, the neighborhood around, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the neighborhood also had tons of obstacles. Right outside of her home, there was a pedestrian overpass that the government had erected as part of its road work leading up to the Olympics, and it's accessible only by stairs. So this woman, Maria, couldn't use that either, and that blocked the way to the main thoroughfare in Adler, Sochi, where you have all the tourist attractions.
Well, this is the interesting thing, because part of the reason for getting the Olympics, part of the requirements of getting the Olympics, is you make everything accessible.
Right.
And so you almost have this, sounds like from what I'm reading, there is a very accessible athletic center where all the activities are going to, but it's inaccessible outside of that little cocoon, really.
Right. I mean, it is significant that Russia is hosting the Paralympics. I mean, this is a country where 34 years before the government said, we won't host the Paralympics because there are no disabled people in the USSR.
This is 1980 in Moscow, when the Olympics were in Moscow, the Summer Olympics.
Exactly.
So this is progress in some way.
This is progress, and the pockets of accessibility in Sochi, like the smattering of cafes and shops that really do have accessible ramps now, are a step forward, as are the lowered sidewalks leading up to the bus station, for example. I mean, those weren't there before. Allowing people who use wheelchairs to enter. Those weren't there before. But it's safe to say that Sochi residents have not benefited nearly as significantly as the tourists and Paralympic athletes who are going to be coming to Sochi in just a few weeks.
Has Human Rights Watch looked at other cities that have hosted the Olympics? Because you have these requirements for every Olympics. Are most modern world cities doing a much better job of accommodating their disabled populations?
That's a good question. We actually didn't look comparatively. When it comes to best practices in employment, for example, we look to other countries. But the report was really on what obligations does Russia have under the Paralympic Charter, and is it meeting them? And our conclusion was that it's not meeting them, but it still has an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. Well, I think I read one person who said they would love to go to that, but they don't think they can negotiate all the obstacles they have to get to the area where the ramps are the proper incline and they're able to negotiate things. Mm-hmm. It's just almost like there's a bubble within the city of Sochi for the disabled.
I would say that there is.
Uh-huh. Human Rights Watch has released this report. What has been the interaction with the Russian government to maybe change some of these things? I gather the sense that a lot of where the disabled live in this particular community is probably far outside the city center. Is that the case?
Is that the case.
Normal?
That is normal. I think that's an issue.
Is that the cheapest housing?
Yeah. I think in Russian cities, many people who I guess are comparable to middle class citizens live far outside the city center because of the generally high expense of housing in Russia. And of course, that has implications for people with disabilities because that means that they're just an additional layer of barriers that you have to overcome to be a full participant in your community.
So what's been the interaction with the Russian government on this issue?
The interaction with the Russian government has been quite productive, actually. They are proud of the fact that they're working actively on accessibility, and the government has achieved a great deal over the past 20 years, and particularly over the past five. So when we came to meetings with federal ministries and with departments from the city of Moscow, they were willing to talk to us. They were not always willing to implement our recommendations, but the tone of the discussions were positive. A good example is our ongoing discussion with the Moscow Department of Transportation and the Department of the Metropolitan. We are advocating for them to make Moscow metro stations more accessible to people with visual impairments. So, for example, tactile strips on the edges of subway platforms. And
there's a very poignant story of one person who said, I think he's fallen off the edge
three times
into the metro.
Yeah.
Because, as he's tapping or whatever, he's, doesn't see the edge of the platform and boom, over he goes.
Yep.
And to be quite honest, that's a situation we're still working on in this country. I mean, every time I turn around, there's streets and in places where those tactile strips are being still installed here in America, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, our position was never that the U.S. does it better. In many ways, I think, you know, we have more protections for people with disabilities, but we... So back to my discussion about meetings with policymakers, we met them in an inaccessible metro station in Moscow, and their position was those tactile strips, you know, come off easily when, you know, people walk on them, so it's not really economical to put them down. What we have is this system of assistance for people. So if they want to leave work in a particular time period, they can call up the city and get somebody to meet them and accompany them to the train. And our activist partners who accompanied us to this meeting kept trying to drive home the point that the issue is not having a helper, it's being able to use the system independently. And we kept disagreeing on that point. But in the end, they did agree to consider putting Braille in subway stations so that people could navigate transfers more easily. And that was a step. So we disagree on a lot, but there are certain things that we can... We've got the government to commit, at least verbally, to considering. In other ways, we've had some more significant gains. In December, the federal government introduced a bill that would require regional and city governments to enforce that really progressive accessibility law that I just mentioned a while ago. And it would basically establish a progressive plan to ensure that infrastructure in throughout Russia was accessible to people with various types of disabilities.
So they're starting to put the enforcement mechanisms in place.
Yep.
Is it true enforcement mechanisms, or, you know, just like you had a strongly worded law, but you had no enforcement mechanisms? Are the enforcement mechanisms actually enforceable?
Well, they haven't done it yet. This was just a bill. Mm-hmm. But we considered it progress because it incorporated directly some of the language of our own recommendations. Mm. So we'll see. The work now is following it through and trying to push for it to actually go into effect, to pass and go into effect and be implemented.
My guest today is Andrea Mazzarino. She is a fellow with Human Rights Watch in their Europe and Central Asia division. She's also the director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University, the Watson Institute.
Project coordinator.
And she's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, mm-hmm. and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, it sounds like, you know, while it's not perfect, it sounds like Russia's making a good faith effort to follow the Convention on Rights of People with Disabilities. Explain that that convention that they ratified just a couple of years ago. The United States is also a signatory and ratifier of that as well?
The United States is actually not. They signed it, but they have not ratified it. And our campaign to push for U.S. ratification is ongoing. What I think is interesting about the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is it's the first convention to be drafted with the active participation of people it's meant to benefit. So people with disabilities took an active role in its drafting. You know, motto of the disability rights movement is nothing about us without us. And the gist of the convention is that people with disabilities must be actively included in their communities as full participants in society. And that's a step away from, you know, a common medical model of disability that sort of involves people with disabilities as recipients of charity and help.
Right. Yeah. And that's the big change, too, is that they want to get, you know, nobody wants to be in that role of being sort of an outsider, being, say, well, this will help you. No, this is what I need. That's sort of the reaction, I would think.
Yeah, this is a really important move for Russia because there are more and more people who are members of Russian NGOs, disability rights NGOs, who are making claims to full social inclusion rather than, you know, historically in Russia, people with disabilities have gotten monthly pensions from the government. And that's still a valuable form of support, but it's still not what people need in order to, for example, you know, get jobs in the community, become active in political movements. So we're hoping that, you know, Russia moves more and more towards compliance with the convention in that respect.
What about issues like that discrimination in the workplace? Is it pretty rampant in Russia, or is Russia a fairly good example?
Yes, it's rampant. We spoke with many people who did not even get to the job interview because when employers learned about their disability, they told them, that they didn't want to take on the responsibility of having an employee with a disability, or they simply said no or declined giving them an interview because their disability was obvious. And employment discrimination is a very big problem among people with disabilities.
If I can follow up on, you know, this convention, what are the central issues that are either keeping a country like the United States from ratifying it or keeping a country that has ratified it, like Russia, to the letter of the convention and of the law?
Okay, so two questions. One is, what keeps a country such as the United States from ratifying the convention? That's something we talk about a lot. One issue is that there are groups in the United States who believe that U.S. ratification would undermine certain powerful interests, like the homeschooling movement. The convention does not mandate, would not make it impossible for parents to homeschool, would not take away their choice. It simply dictates that inclusive education in schools be available.
So there's a fear about the homeschooling movement.
Fear about the homeschooling movement. Fear, I mean, there are people who oppose abortion who believe that the right to health care on an equal basis for others, including for women, would undermine.
Now, is this a part of the convention as far as just equal access to health care?
Yes, yeah. It is. Okay. So people read all kinds of things into the convention, and there are real fears that the U.S. ratification of the convention will undermine those interests, even though the convention, I mean, drafters of the convention used as one of their models, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Oh. So is it really codifying a lot of things in the ADA already, or does it go a step or two further?
It codifies aspects of the ADA, and it goes a step or two further as well.
Mm. Of course, our Congress right now is not in the process, or they're not in the habit of really ratifying any international agreements. I think that's sort of a feature of the gridlock in Washington. But it sounds like there are powerful interests opposed to ratifying this in the United States.
There are. There absolutely are.
What about the idea of living up to the letter, that second part of the question?
Yes. So what keeps Russia from implementing the convention?
Yeah. Or is it a matter of just time and money?
Well, I don't think Russia's short on money to implement the convention. I don't think that's the issue. I think time is definitely an issue. It is going to take time because one of the most powerful barriers to change in Russia is attitudes. One of the problems that we ran into frequently, other than the employment discrimination issue, for example, was that local government officials, bus drivers, teachers, were simply not aware of the rights of persons with disabilities and weren't aware of, you know, how to accommodate people so that they could become included in their communities. There were people who use wheelchairs who told us that buses passed by them at bus stops and wouldn't lower the platforms on those buttons.
Just didn't want to take time. Yeah. They put them off schedule maybe or whatever, or whatever reason, yeah.
Exactly. And you can add low-floored buses to cities, but I think attitudes take a little bit longer to change.
My guest today is Andrea Mazzarino. She is a fellow with Human Rights Watch. She's serving in the Europe and Central Asia Division. She's been working on the issue of accessibility, especially all across Russia, but especially with the eyes of the world on Sochi. And, of course, next month it'll be the Paralympics in Sochi, the Winter Paralympics. And I assume there has been a massive building campaign to accommodate that in Sochi. What's actually happened on Sochi on that front?
Well, the government has added over 100 buses with platforms so that people with limited mobility can board. They have made Sochi's central bus station accessible to people who use wheelchairs. They've added ramps to several tourist businesses, so cafes and shops. And the airport has become a lot more accessible, not just accommodations for people with physical disabilities, but contrast paint, for example, on the edges of restroom entrances so that people with low vision can orient themselves. Those are all really significant changes, and the Olympic Park itself has many really important accommodations for people with disabilities, including, for example, audio equipment so that people who are blind and low vision can listen to play-by-play announcements of events. These are all really significant things, but they don't mean that Sochi residents have, that their lives have improved significantly. And it's easy to forget that Russia has an obligation as a host country to leave a legacy of inclusion and integration for people with disabilities.
You mentioned that attitude is perhaps one of the biggest obstacles to overcome in Russia. Can the Paralympics be the catalyst for changing attitudes?
I think that they can be a catalyst, but it's not going to happen magically. I think that the Paralympics will become a catalyst for change only if the government takes seriously its obligation to keep working on these issues and do concrete things to change attitudes, to make, you know, services and infrastructure accessible. In and of itself, watching Paralympic athletes compete is not going to have the mileage that I think some think it will. Because if people like Maria in Sochi can't leave their homes, then Paralympic athletes might seem like exceptions to the rule.
Right. Well, I was thinking about the idea of the average non-disabled Russian who is, it's out of sight, out of mind. I can't be bothered with it. All of a sudden they see these incredible athletes. Maybe it does change the mind. Maybe they will stop the bus to lower the platform.
It couldn't hurt. I mean, a Paralympic athlete, that's a wonderful example of somebody who is in command of their lives and can gracefully navigate their physical environment. But I think that will only go so far unless that is followed by sustained systemic efforts to make ordinary Russian citizens with disabilities parts of their communities.
Has this been an issue you've always been involved with, or has this come out of your service at Human Rights Watch?
This has come out of my service at Human Rights Watch. I was handed this issue when I first came to work at Human Rights Watch. I have a background on gender, women's rights in the workforce. So in a sense, I have been working on social and economic rights for a long time in Russia. So disability rights was sort of a continuation of that.
How's that changed you?
That has changed me in a lot of ways. It's made me realize that the world doesn't need to be built the way it is. I mean, things as simple as, you know, stairs instead of a ramp mean that many, many people can't perform the basic tasks of everyday life. So it's changed the way I look at ordinary objects in my urban environment, whether that's in New York or in Moscow. Looking around now, I see that something like a subway station or in Moscow, a metro station isn't so innocuous. It contains potential for real human rights violations if certain accommodations that are easy to do are not made.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with your work.
Thank you.
Andrea, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Andrea Mazzarino is an anthropologist specializing in contemporary Russia. She is currently a fellow at the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week. Well, today marks the 10th anniversary of Facebook. Let's face it, some people love it. Actually, a lot of people love it. But there are others that really hate it. Well, today, we have an official reversal from commentator Barry Friedman.
I need to apologize to Facebook. You heard right. A few years back, I wrote a horrendous commentary right here about Facebook and the vacuity of those on it. The insights were as deep as a kiddie pool, it was poorly researched, and I took cheap shots at people who posted cat photos. I want to correct that now. I posted cat photos. It was really cute. We had this cat. We thought it was a male, turned out to be a female, had kittens. Hilarity ensued. But I digress. Something happened to me because I now look forward to Facebook and its cherry-picked statistics on ACA, its quotes from God, its stick figures, its selfie photos, its birthday reminders, its pleas for mechanics in the area. I'm addicted. My daughter, who just turned 25, said, "Dad, you're worse than a teenage girl." I could tell you, I do it for the marketing, for getting my work out, including these commentaries to a wider audience, and there's some of that, but it's the human contact I want, as counterintuitive as that sounds. It's the likes. My son would have been 30. He died 6 years ago, and I tell you this because Facebook made the insupportable bearable. I posted Paul's picture on my homepage. I linked to an essay I'd written. The responses, the support, the good wishes, and the love I received felt, and I don't know how else to describe this to you, like prayers. Let me explain. On that day, hundreds of people, most of whom didn't know me, much less Paul, and certainly didn't know each other, seemed simultaneously to think about my son and his death and me and my pain. All day, their thoughts were linked with mine. To me, that's prayer. It was as palpable as if they were surrounding me in a sanctuary. And if Candy Crush invitations are Facebook, so too is a note from a woman in Indonesia in a hijab who said my son was handsome. And now to Gary and Sharon. I met Gary on Facebook, for his college roommate was Charlie Pierce of Esquire, on whose blog I've spent most of my last 18 months. Gary and I talked baseball and politics and relationships, and eventually he invited Melissa and me down to Dallas. We decided to go. It felt like a blind date. Melissa and I figured if it didn't go well, we would be one meal out of our lives. We'd be in Dallas. We'd survive. We'd go to IKEA. Dinner was scheduled. We met in the lobby of our hotel. They looked like a Gary and Sharon should look. My fear is that everyone you meet online is a 700-pound shut-in, watching a black-and-white television, petting a mangy dog, and eating soup from a can. But Gary and Sharon were normal human beings. They looked like us. The friendship was immediate, like walking into a college dorm and knowing you and your roommate will get along. We hugged them, they hugged us, strangers. Later that night, at dinner, Gary decided to call Charlie, so there I was, having dinner with someone I didn't know, talking on the phone with someone else I didn't know, yet it felt oddly like three friends catching up. Remarkably real, yet by any standard, not. We took pictures, mostly of Sharon and Melissa, which we posted. Charlie made fun in the comments, we made fun of him making fun. So, okay, Facebook is now forwarding everything I've ever written to the NSA, but I forgive it, for at that moment, in a steakhouse in Dallas, Zuckerberg deserved all his billions. He brought people who otherwise wouldn't have been together, together. Someone asked Laurence Olivier once why he acted, and he said the same reason everyone else does. Love me, love me, love me. I think I'll update my status with that.
Barry Friedman is a prolific Facebook poster, writer, stand-up comic, and columnist at the Tulsa Voice, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Be sure and check out some of our past episodes on our website at publicradiotulsa.org. You can search through our archives and listen to past shows on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.